This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. I want to introduce you to a man named Mark, who on a lot of days wakes up early to get going.
I'm going to use the bathroom real quick and then pull out the covers on my windows and get started on the way to the gym.
Mark lives in L.A. on La Cienega Boulevard, and he goes to the gym every single morning.
Okay, about 7 short minutes later, I have arrived at the gym, and I'm just going to fold down the rear seat of my car to the hidden secret compartment in the trunk that I built to carry my clothes. And the hidden compartment is because for supplemental money, I drive for Uber and Lyft, and my car has to appear clean and professional and give no clue that I live in it every night.
Yeah, that's right. Mark lives in his car, like about 16,000 other people in Los Angeles.
And I don't have time today for a full workout, so I'm going to run in and use the bathroom and shave and shower and get ready, look professional for work. And I'll check back in with you in about 45 minutes.
Today, Mark's running on about 4 hours of sleep and is about to head into a 14-hour day as a driver.
So, 5 a.m., 45 minutes later, I am pulling out of the gym parking lot and assessing my situation to be ready to do my job for the day. My shift begins at 6 a.m. and I have to get a tank of gas. And
if you belong to a gym, it might just be a place you go to use the elliptical. It might be a bitter reminder of a New Year's resolution made and then abandoned. But if you're without a stable place to live, the gym might be a lot more than that. It might be a lifeline, a kind of home base. And for Mark, the gym is somewhere he knows he'll always be allowed to go to use the bathroom or the shower, just to be inside and to prepare himself for a day of pretending that he's not living in his car.
And that's it for right now. I just arrived at the 7-Eleven, which is a multiple times a day stop for me. I'm going to get my first morning coffee and some breakfast and move on to start my shift shortly.
Reporter Carla Green spoke to people living in their cars and on the streets about the gym and why a gym membership can be the key to keeping it together when you find yourself without a place to live.
When I first met Mark, I never would have guessed that he lives in his car. Mark is a clean-cut guy, looks meticulously put together. He was wearing cargo shorts and a short-sleeved plaid shirt. I met him at a dinner hosted by a synagogue that volunteers its parking lot every night so that people living in their cars can have a safe place to sleep. It's one of several safe parking programs in Los Angeles. And at first, I figured Mark was a member of the synagogue. Mark gave me his last name, but asked that we not use it to maintain his privacy. Some people in his life, his employers and customers, for example, don't know about his living situation.
It's really difficult living in a car. There's not enough room for a person to lay out like they're in a bed. So you're in a very uncomfortable position.
How do you sleep on the back seat? Or?
Yeah, so I use the back bench seat and I basically go fetal position.
Mark hadn't been homeless for long when he realized he wasn't going to make it without a gym membership.
The reality is you can last about 3 days living in your car before you need to get to an adequate place to shower and promote and keep your hygiene up, and you begin to be noticed by the other people in society that you're looking scruffy and looking homeless, and maybe you're even, you know, smelling. And so I had a gym membership that I found critical to my survival in this lifestyle.
The story of Mark moving into his car starts, as many similar stories do, with Mark living in an apartment and with things suddenly spiraling out of control.
I had lived for the last 10 years in a really cool beach community in North County, San Diego, and I really loved my place. And so I had always been in the habit of keeping about $3,000 emergency funds available, and I had gotten so comfortable living there and knowing that that was my home. I had been there for 10 years that I dipped into my emergency fund to complete a project.
But while Mark was spending down his emergency money to build an outdoor kitchen, the other person on the lease was making plans to leave. Mark couldn't afford to pay the full rent on his own, so eventually he decided to move, temporarily, into his car. That was more than a year ago.
A lot of this experience for the last year and a half of being homeless for me has been a sort of stoic experiment where I'm like, I didn't want to ask for help because I knew there were people who really needed help. But you wake up enough times with the fingerprints of drug addicts looking through, trying to peer through the tint on your window to see who's on the other side of that window snoring, and it makes for a very restless, fearful sleep.
Finally, after over a year of sleeping in his car on the streets, Mark heard about programs at parking lots like the synagogues. So for the first time since he'd moved into his car, he decided to ask for help. Emily Wade-Cantrum is the associate director of Safe Parking LA, which coordinates the synagogue's program and a half dozen others like it around the city. Wade-Cantrum recognizes that if you're living in your car, there are a couple things you need: a safe place to sleep, reliable access to a bathroom, and, for a lot of people, membership to a gym. So when the Safe Parking program opened on their lot, synagogue members decided to fund gym memberships for the people who sleep there every night.
The absolute best housing opportunities, just like job opportunities, come from someone you know. And the more you're able to stay connected to your larger community and larger societal groups, you're more likely to be able to see yourself back in those pathways and find those kinds of resources. So part of, and I don't want to say keeping up the facade, but keeping up the ability to see yourself as part of a housed community is important.
For some people, the gym is even more than a place to clean up and make sure you don't appear homeless to the outside world. It can be a sanctuary from the harsh realities of life without a stable home.
Well, right now we're at Planet Fitness. This was my basic escape space. Like, I would use this place to make me feel like I'm not living on the streets type thing, like I'm a normal person. I mean, you know, we're all normal people, but...
This is Santiago Tarver, who lived first in his car and then in a tent in Skid Row. He since moved into an apartment.
So when you get inside, all of a sudden, it's quieter. It's cooler.
It's cooler. It's not all extra hot like it is outside. And the environment and the energy is just totally different from outside.
What's it like?
More pleasant, more calming, more relaxing, and not as chaotic.
I've heard, off the record, that it's common knowledge among gym employees that people who are homeless are among their members, and that those members use the gym just like Mark and Santiago do. I tried to talk to a couple different gyms on the record for this story, and none wanted to comment. The gym can be a useful tool for keeping up the appearance of being housed when you're without a home. But people using the gym that way know that they're in a precarious situation, that it's a delicate balance. Like Erica Newsom. Erica was working at a bank when she got evicted. The rent went up, her pay didn't, and the added cost was just too much to manage. When it happened, she was pragmatic about it, immediately went into problem-solving mode.
So during that process, I had to figure out, what am I going to do? Like, where am I going to put my stuff? Like, how I'm going to work out where I'm able to be able to have access to showers? I'm going to be able to be presentable at work. And also at the same time, I noticed in my building, in my bank where I worked, there was a gym called LA Fitness.
So she carefully assembled the structure of her new houseless life. She worked at the bank. She slept in her car in the bank's parking structure. And she showered at the gym, all in the same building.
And then what about after work?
So then I'll go back to the gym because I know I make sure I take a nice shower, make sure I use the facilities, because once they close at 11, if I have to go to the bathroom, everything's closed at public parks. They close their public restrooms at a certain time. So if I don't take care of things before the gym closes, you know, then I'm screwed when I'm in my car. I'm definitely. So that's pretty much my day, is I make sure that I did things at a certain time. So in the middle of the night, I'm not stuck.
During this time, a lot of Erica's mental energy ended up going towards planning the basic facts of her life, going to the bathroom or getting clean. and also to concealing her living situation from her colleagues.
Well, first, mostly it was embarrassing because it was like, okay, everyone works at the bank. Everyone has, you know, a car. They have a place to go to. They have a home. So once they work, they just get on and leave. And me, it's kind of like, to make sure they didn't find out, I had to kind of pretend like I was leaving. Like I will just drive off and maybe go to the storage. So it looked like I was going home. But in reality, I was just going to the storage facility or just making a little round trip around the corner so I can go back in the parking structure and go to the gym.
Eventually, Erica's boss found out, and Erica admits her work had been slipping. It was distracting not having a place to live. She got fired.
I left and went to my car. The first thing I did is I drove all the way up to the top six-story parking structure, and I was actually about to jump. I felt that I had nothing left. You know, that's it was going to jump. But then before I did, my therapist I seen earlier, I guess she gave me a card for a next appointment. Her car fell out of like my dress pants. And then I saw that that's made me go, I need to go back and see her to let her know what happened.
When I last spoke to Erica, she was doing better, had her own place. Mark is still in his car, still working and saving up. A couple days ago, he texted me that he met up with a friend from San Diego and that they were each surprised to learn that the other was, as he puts it, discreetly homeless. It's common, he said. For KCRW, I'm Carla Green.
Well, it's stories like that one, with an emphasis on an issue, housing homelessness, that affects so many people here in Southern California, that your contribution actually helps to support in KCRW's UnDrive Pledge Drive. We can provide those stories for you to make a difference in the lives of many, many people across Southern California. Quality journalism, music, and cultural programs that feed your need for entertainment and information. We cannot do it without you. And today, there's a challenge on the table from a generous KCRW supporter. Board member Sari Kane matches your contribution dollar for dollar if we can raise $35,000 by midnight tomorrow night. KCRW.com/join. And thank you for your support. Coming up, the climate is changing, what you can do, and how LA will look in the coming decades, right on the other side of this. This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. As you probably know, leaders from around the world have convened today at the United Nations to talk about Earth, specifically how the planet's climate is changing and what human beings are doing to A, continue to make it worse, and B, come together to try and find a solution, or not. A whole lot of young people around the world walked out of their classrooms and offices and took to the streets on Friday to draw attention to the problem, including many all over Greater LA.
I'm Alexandra Rafling. I'm 15, and I'm out here because, frankly, the state of our planet nowadays is absolutely terrifying. And I think if we all get out here and show that we are dedicated to providing a better future for ourselves and our children, our lawmakers will have no choice but to listen to us and vote in that favor.
I had a mental breakdown the other day because I'm like, well, what's the point of me doing anything in school? What's the point of me trying to be anything when I grow up if the world's going to die?
I'm here because I want my grandchildren to live on the earth that I'm living on today.
KCRW is participating in a week-long series of programming on the issue of climate change, and there have been some dire predictions about its impact in the coming years. Right now, we're going to talk about how the warming planet will affect us right here in Southern California in those coming years and decades. Alex Hall heads up UCLA's Center for Climate Science. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You bet. The climate is changing. We know that. Scientists, the vast majority of scientists on Earth, say the climate is changing, and a large part of that is a rising temperature. So how are Southern California temperatures going to change in the coming years and decades? How much warmer is it going to get?
Well, we've already seen significant warming in California on the order of a degree or two Fahrenheit over the past century, and we'll continue to see rising temperatures over the coming decades. By the mid-century, we should see temperature increases on average of 3 to 4 degrees Fahrenheit, and that has big implications for a lot of things, including heat extremes in Southern California.
How do we know that? How do we know temperatures? I mean, we know the temperatures have been rising in the past. How do we know that they're going to continue to rise?
Well, we know that when you increase greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, that leads to warming. And we know that greenhouse gases are increasing in the atmosphere due to emissions, due to fossil fuel burning. And we know that's going to continue to a large degree. And so we can then predict how that will impact temperatures by just asking the question, how much extra heat is trapped by those projected increases in greenhouse gases?
And the effects will be felt in different places in different ways, right? Like people along the coast aren't going to be as warm as the people inland, which is what we see right now.
Right. So in Southern California, we already have temperatures that are very different inland than near the coast. If you look near the coast, temperatures are typically cooler. There's a natural air conditioning that comes from the ocean, from the nice breeze that we get during the afternoon from the ocean. And that effect will continue to moderate temperatures very near the coast. But if you go even just a little bit inland, say even to downtown Los Angeles, you'll see pretty big increases in temperature and big increases in heat extremes.
So we're talking about several degrees over the course of decades. It doesn't sound like a whole lot, 1 degree here, 2 degrees there. It does mean that LA's average summer highs will be much hotter toward the end of the century, right?
Yeah, so if you look further it forward in time and you look at the end of the century and you imagine that we keep increasing greenhouse gas emissions as we have, you really see Los Angeles becoming a very different place. So the winters would become much more like the spring and fall that we have now, and the spring and fall that we have now would become much more like summer, and our summers would become something that we just don't have here in Los Angeles, something much closer to what Phoenix, for example, experiences during the summertime.
Phoenix is hot in the summer, as we know. Phoenix is also just today seeing a lot of flooding. Monsoonal rains that don't really happen in Phoenix very often. And I wonder, because we're talking about water as well, it's not just heat, it's water as well. And that's a big one for us here in Southern California. What does climate change mean for our water supply and the precipitation that happens here in these parts?
So climate change has huge implications for our water resources. We already live in a region that is semi-arid and is reliant on distant water sources for our supply of water. And those water sources are vulnerable to climate change. So, for example, if you look in the Sierra Nevada, where we get a lot of our water, we are projecting that warming would cause a huge decline in snowpack, probably something like a third of a decline in the snowpack by the end of the century. And that snowpack is a natural reservoir of water. And if we lose it, we lose that natural storage capacity. We also project a big increase in precipitation extremes, so bigger swings between very wet years and deeper droughts. And that also has big implications for our water resources because it's going to be harder for us to get through these very dry periods and also harder for us to store water during the wet period so that we can make it through the next drought.
And when things are really dry, things go up in flames, right? Any kind of spark can cause a catastrophe.
And as your audience knows, I'm sure we've already seen a significant uptick in the intensity and size of wildfire in California. And that is primarily due to warming that we've seen already. And then in addition, the change in extremes and precipitation also has implications for wildfire because during wet years, you build up fuels for fire. And then during dry years, they dry out and are prone to burn. And if you increase the swings in precipitation between very wet years and very dry years, you're going to increase the amount of fuels that are available for fire. And you're going to decrease the moisture in those fuels during the dry periods, and that's going to lead to a larger fire.
And all those fires, of course, mean a lot of smoke. Air quality suffers in a situation like this as well, correct?
Right. So when there's a big fire, there's obviously a lot of smoke produced, and that has big implications for air quality. I think everyone who's been in Los Angeles during a big wildfire knows that the air quality goes down. And when the temperatures are warmer, too, we see a decline in air quality, whether or not we're in a fire situation, because a lot of the chemical reactions that lead to a decline in air quality are sensitive to temperature.
But it's also, when you talk about on a global scale, warmer temperatures mean ice sheets and places where there's a lot of ice melting very quickly. We're seeing it in Greenland. We're seeing it in Antarctica. And that means the sea levels will rise all around the globe, correct?
Yeah, so we're already seeing acceleration of melt in Greenland, and we're seeing signs that Antarctica is also beginning to melt. And if these ice sheets were to melt entirely, they would have a dramatic increase on sea level. So if Greenland were to melt, it would raise sea level by something like 7 meters. And if Antarctica were to melt, it would raise sea level by something like 70 meters.
Ugh.
And that has big relevance for California. So if you look at our coasts, we have certain parts of our coasts that are really vulnerable. In Southern California, the ports of LA and Long Beach are vulnerable to sea level rise because they're relatively low-lying, and those are very important parts of our economic infrastructure. Places like Marina del Rey are also low-lying and very subject to flooding. Our beaches are vulnerable because it's going to be much harder for us to replenish the beaches and maintain them. And we also have examples of cliff erosion.
And it's all happening, right? These are things that have happened already. We've seen a rise in sea level. We've seen erosion on the beach and on the cliffs and things like that.
Absolutely. We've already seen sea level rise significantly over the past century. That's due to the warming of the ocean waters. They just take up more room as they get warmer. And that's also due to the melting of glaciers and the drawdown of aquifers, which are bringing groundwater into rivers and streams and putting it into the ocean. All those things are contributing to the observed rise in sea level, and we expect those trends to continue.
You know, we started the conversation, Professor, with, you know, hearing from young people protesting the lack of action on global warming and climate change. What do you think we should be doing? I mean, what can we do to play our part in trying to turn this around?
Well, that's a great question. And I think the first thing that we have to do is acknowledge that we are part of bigger systems. If you look at decisions about energy, especially long-term energy planning, those are, to a certain extent, made at the national level. And we have to get involved in politics if we want to make those changes. We need political change in order for those changes to occur. So I think that's part of the answer, is to get involved. And it's great to see these young people demanding change, because I think that's a big part of what we have to do. Now, of course, there are individual decisions that can have an impact. If you look in Los Angeles, about half of our greenhouse gas emissions come from the transportation sector. So that points to us making better decisions about things related to transportation. It means supporting land use and urban planning decisions that would encourage biking and walking. So it means supporting higher density in areas where it makes sense. It means supporting the public transit infrastructure and using public transit when we can. We have an evolving public transit infrastructure that's getting better and better, which is great to see, but we have to support that. And it means that when you make a new vehicle purchase, you need to make sure that you buy either an electric vehicle or a plug-in hybrid. You know, you need to make sure that you're buying a car that does not or emits as few greenhouse gases as possible. About 8% of current vehicle sales are either EVs or plug-in hybrids, and that's been great progress, but that number is really too low. Everybody who purchases a vehicle now needs to be purchasing an EV or a plug-in hybrid.
By the way, you walk the walk, as it were. You're a bicyclist, right? You bike to work.
So I'm multimodal. I bike to work sometimes. I take the bus sometimes, and sometimes I drive my EV.
And so, I mean, these are things that all of us can do to mitigate what's going on with the Earth's climate and an ever-changing climate. I want to thank you, Professor Alex Hall, who heads up the Center for Climate Science over at UCLA. Alex, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
And as we march our way out of here today, we are close to the finish line, the final 2 days of KCRW's UnDrive Pledge Drive, where we once again try to prove that typical long-form blah, blah, blah public radio fundraising is a thing of the past. But we really do need you to make this really successful, to step up and help us out and make what we do possible. Think of what it is that you listen to this radio station for each and every day, how you use KCRW. Put a dollar value to it. and help us out as we wrap things up in the next couple of days. We do have this challenge to report. If we can raise $35,000 by tomorrow night at midnight, your contribution will get matched dollar for dollar, courtesy of our KCRW board member, Sarah Kane. So thank you. And you'll be entered to win an unforgettable five-day getaway for two to Sonoma. KCRW.com/join. And thank you. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for the ear and for your time. Have yourself a great day.